My name is Zach Galler, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Good evening, Ilya. How the hell are you?
I'm just fine. Good evening, Ben Rock. How the hell are
it's
you?
Like a, it's like a shove of an intro. I'm doing great. I'm doing great here in Sherman Oaks, California. Doing my thing. Who is on the show today?
It's an interview that you did. It's with cinematographer Zachary Galler.
Zachary Galler of Lessons in Chemistry, which I think is a show that everyone should check out. It's really freaking awesome. It's got a great cast. Brie Larson looks amazing. It's a wonderful show, and I'm really glad that we got to talk about it. He kind of talks about making a period piece, about collaborating with other DPs on the same series. Lot of great information, and he's a cool guy. So looking forward to whatever he does next.
Right on. Well, I look forward to hearing your interview. Should be good.
Should be. his part of it is great. I won't make any excuses for myself. So.
And now, Close Focus.
All right. So Ben, it is our Close Focus time of the show. It's the time when we talk about current events, what's going on in the industry. Seems like it was kind of a consequential last few days in Hollywood. What are we talking about?
Well, not to do what I did again last week, which is to reference IndieWire, a fine online publication about the film industry, but they have an article that I think should be read by just about everyone on here. We'll include a link in the show notes. It's called "This Was the Week That Cable TV Died," which is an inflammatory thing to say.
For sure.
And when I first told you about it, you were like, anyone who says cable TV is dead is exaggerating. And I'm like, I agree. But
it wasn't good news. It wasn't good news for all of cable. Some cable did okay. In fact, cable over at Paramount looks like was a real profit center for other parts of Paramount, which weren't quite doing so well. So,
yeah, I mean, we've just had kind of, you know, linear television, as it's called, which is, you know, sort of when you go over to your parents' house and they still have the cable subscription and you can like flip
through the channels. Linear TV. Yeah, that's right.
Linear. Yeah. Although actually I still have a cable subscription, but
yeah, look at you knocking people's parents out there when you should just be saying like, when you come over to my house in the living room, it's linear television.
I just
want
to point out that I'm somebody's parent. this article kind of talks about a few companies, one that has been in the news more than I would like to see, which is Warner Brothers Discovery, the merger that keeps on merging. It's been kind of a disaster. I pitched you the idea, and I almost feel like we should do it, of like the David Zaslav unemployment pool. Like, how long before David Zaslav is not running Warner Discovery? But I feel like almost everything he has done over there has just blown up in his face. And now they've lost the NBA, and with that was like, correct me if I'm wrong, was it not billions of loss? Billions.
Yeah, they wrote down the value of Warner Brothers Discovery by $9 billion, a $9 billion reduction in total value of the enterprise, which if you look back over the last year, basically since David Zaslav has come into his position as the, you know, top banana, they've lost 70% of their value, and the stock is trading at near historic lows, at least as far as I can tell.
As of this recording, under $7 a share.
Under $7 a share. So, yeah. I got to imagine that there's some people none too happy about that. And likewise, you know, there's been some devaluing, changing of the valuing over at AMC and over at Paramount, of course, with now the acquisition from Skydance. So, it's interesting to see what's going on currently in the landscape of linear television and the streaming services and these big conglomerates. They're trying to figure out their values. And likewise, Paramount is also trading at rather about $10 a share now, very low historically speaking.
Well, and this was talked about extensively, and probably will still be talked about extensively on Matt Bellamy's The Town podcast. They've done a lot of autopsying of the Paramount thing even before it happened, when they were talking about will it happen, and there was always that talk of like, what is the value of the legacy media companies that that Paramount owns under its umbrella, things like MTV and BET,
yeah,
which people think BET actually has legs in terms of value. Comedy Central, which I think is having a bit of a bounce lately, at least, you know, with The Daily Show and Jon Stewart's return and some of that kind of stuff. But sure, it's kind of weird to think, like, culturally, how different we live now versus even 10 years ago. When, you know, like, this stuff was like the water cooler stuff of our lives 20, 30 years ago, and things like MTV, VH1.
It leads right into the other thing we were talking about earlier, which is Sunday night was HBO, and Warner Brothers Discovery, there's really no HBO anymore. It's just Max. And along with that, it's like appointment television. The appointment television of Sunday night watching HBO is not really a thing anymore. And there's a whole bunch of talk about future series, but for the rest of 2024, Max doesn't have a lot of new appointment television to go out there. So
yeah,
it's
they're done with House of the Dragon. Like, House of the Dragon season two is over. Is it three?
Two. Yeah.
Two. I should know this because I just talked to the DP. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, so, you know, House of the Dragon. I mean, there are things like I Love John Oliver, and that drops every Sunday night, but, you know, there was a time where, you know, it's like whether it was The Sopranos or 6 Feet Under or True Blood or Girls or whatever it was, there was like a big new thing on HBO on Sunday night.
Even Succession, which was not as popular as some of these other shows you just mentioned. Succession, you know, had a hardcore following of people who wanted to watch it every Sunday night. I was one of them. So
me too. Yeah, I love that show.
Well, it's interesting to see what's happening. I do definitely think that one of the ways that you get out of this sort of state that they found themselves in is, dun dun dun, invest in new programming. You know, it's like there has been two different strikes. The third strike, which everyone was kind of holding their breath for in this industry, is now averted officially. So there's some real optimism and excitement.
Well, I know
about IATSE Hollywood
isn't happening, but what about Teamsters? Do we know about Teamsters?
Yes, 100% Teamsters signed and ratified the deal, so there is no strike. And I have seen since then two different crew parking signs in Los Angeles, which is awesome. I love to see that stuff is getting back to work. I saw a stake bed filled with like DIT equipment rolling down the highway. I had not seen anything like that in ages. So really, just this past week, there is signs of Hollywood starting to crawl back forward again. So I think that's really, really good. And having some really excellent movies and television is sure a way to get people, you know, subscribing to your services, watching, talking about it. The better stuff they make, the more attention they're going to get.
Yeah, well, but the problem is, if they're all devalued and they're not worth as much money, how do they leverage themselves to produce the new shows?
It's a great question, but there's a lot of expectations that interest rates are going to get cut, so it will be cheaper to borrow money, supposedly coming in the fall, and there's an awful lot of people out there who like to borrow money to make movies and television.
I'm not one of them.
Yes, anyway. there are some people out there who also like gamble their homes and do all kinds of other crazy things to make a movie and so or television.
Run up a bunch of credit cards.
Yes, anyway. Exactly. It's kind of a famous. So, famous.
Should we start the David Zaslav clock? How long do you think?
Absolutely,
David
Zaslav.
How long do you think Dave has?
Today is August 12th, and he's still not fired. So when we, you know, check back in a week, we'll see if he's fired. He's probably not fired.
We could do a weekly check-in, but I want to put a date out. I want to say Zaslav is gone. I'm going to say by 2025, no Zaslav.
So you say by January 1st?
By January 1st, Zaslav is gone. And I'm probably wrong, but I feel like you don't so publicly make so many wrong moves so bigly as he has and then keep your job.
I'm gonna think that he might hang on a little bit longer. I mean, we could both be completely wrong here, but I'm gonna say Valentine's Day. I'm gonna say he's out of work by Valentine's Day.
You're 2025. Only giving him like two more months than I am.
Exactly. I'm giving him two more months. So that's my guess right now. So sometime between January 1st and Valentine's Day. That's
He makes like $60 million a year. So
something like that.
I don't feel like I'm being mean. He'll still be more rich than everybody I've ever known.
That's right. He makes way more money than the president. He makes way more money than a lot of different media company CEOs out there. He is a baller with a capital B.
I know, and he gets paid that much money to confuse me when I open up Max to not know if I'm watching a low rent documentary like docu follow show about serial killers or a high end HBO documentary about serial killers.
You know, I swear there are so many versions of 90 Day Fiancé, a show I have never watched. But let me tell you, you'd never know it from what the algorithm I guess thinks of me, because I get shown like, hey, it's 90 Day Fiancé in here, 90 Day Fiance in this 90 Day Fiance. It's like, holy crap, is there a lot of 90 Day Fiance? Yeah, well, anyway,
don't get me started about the algorithm. I'm sure that's not his fault. Anyway, so let's go ahead and get to the interview with Zachary Goller.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast interview.
First of all, thank you so much for coming on the show, and congratulations on your Emmy nomination. It's a really amazing show, and it's a killer period piece. And I was happy to actually learn that it was an LA based story that you actually shot in Los Angeles. Like you were like, I was looking up the locations, and you're all over Pasadena and stuff like that, which brings us makes me happy, because so often now when it's LA, it's like, yeah, we shot Atlanta for LA. No disrespect for anyone who does that, but it was quite cool. So let's just start by, tell me like your first impressions when you came on, like what drew you to the material?
Well, let me start by saying thank you so much for having me. And it's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh my God. No, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Listen all the time. So
you do?
Exciting.
How much of an idiot do I sound like? 'Cause I'm not a cinematographer. So like, I'm always afraid that I'm sticking my foot in my mouth left and right.
Not at all. You sound great. Yeah.
It's all about me. Anyway, yeah.
And also just second the love for LA and shooting there.
Yeah.
From there, and it's always been a dream to come there and work, and it was through a fluke and good luck I got to come there. And
as I'm talking to you now, you're on the East Coast.
I am. I'm in New York. Nice. Working on something else, but yeah, it was great. It's great working there, and more people should do it. First impressions coming to this project were just excitement about the scope of the project, the idea of doing a period piece, especially with the scale and the resources that Apple seemed to be committing to it. It was really exciting and sort of a lovely thing to be able to think about with an open mind and come to without a lot of roadblocks for what we might be able to do. I think the initial thing that I hope we achieved was to not be nostalgic about the period and not be like looking back with rose-colored glasses on a time that was not great for everybody, and sort of like looking at it in a way to get people invested early on and be subjective with the camera in a way that they might, you know, look at the past and be able to see how that pertains to stuff that's happening today, and be able to see themselves in the characters and not be objective with the characters and not be far away from the characters in a way that sometimes you get with period pieces. So that was kind of the initial sort of like fun thing to think about was a subjective period piece, I guess I'd say, and something that was lived in.
Yeah, well, and that was one thing I noticed about it. I mean, to me, like the gold standard of like the lived in period piece is like L.A. Confidential or something like that, or Chinatown, like movies where it feels like it doesn't feel like they set dressed it. It feels like I'm looking at the mess that that person would have made at their desk in that time period. And I actually, I know this is more of an art direction thing than a cinematography thing, although you're choosing to film it. But like when we're in the labs, for instance, like the lab, we've all seen it, you know, movies or TV shows or whatever, where the lab looks like everything just got unpacked out of the plastic wrap that day and set up for the first time. But everything did kind of have kind of a lived in feel. Now, like from a cinematography standpoint, how do you approach that? Like, you know, in terms of lensing, lighting, camera movement, et cetera.
Well, labs were funny specifically because I was, you know, initially pretty excited because, oh, there's lots of like glass and there'll be funky things happening. Not that it was going to be some kind of like mad scientist situation in there, but like we have science advisors, so they could be doing real things in there and the actors could be doing real, you know, stuff. And we learned that like so much of what chemists do is actually just like pouring clear liquids into other clear liquids, and there was it didn't have the sort of visual excitement other than, you know, having glass and shiny things in there that we were hoping for. But I think just as far as like the lived in nature of things in a period piece, we tried to stay away from symmetry whenever possible, and tried to not necessarily go to inserts or plan coverage around doing sort of informational shots when we could work things in to the coverage. We always tried to do that. And just tried to shoot as few shots as possible to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that was all just sort of in that service of bringing people in and trying to bring the viewer just closer to these characters quickly. Because the arc of the whole season, we really wanted everybody to be kind of like in bed with us by, you know, the end of the first episode and beginning of the second episode.
No, and that definitely works. And I noticed, well, I mean, I'd love to hear your opinion. I mean, like, this is just like me as the casual viewer, but like your lighting approach, it seemed like you were given like lots of, you know, even the lab felt like kind of a big cavernous lab. And then you've got like a you know, in the first episode, which is the one you're nominated for, there's like a big sequence in a theater, you know, and I feel like it's a lot of like big spaces with a lot of light coming in from the outside. And I kept noticing too, that like, especially with Brie Larson, like I felt like even with that in a kind of a brightly lit world that you were creating, it felt like the camera facing side of her face was often in shadow, not like completely in shadow, but, you know, a few stops darker than everything else. And I was wondering what the thought process was behind kind of designing your whole lighting scheme for the show.
I worked with an amazing gaffer named Glenn Levine, LA based gaffer, who's done tons of projects, big and small, up to Avatar and like Marriage Story and all kinds of just lots of great looking stuff. And we, from the beginning, wanted to light the spaces. Like I think that's the approach that I'll always start from, is lighting the space. And then, you know, when giving the director and actors space to work within a set, where I'll never say to them, oh, don't go over here, don't go over here, we can't light it, or it's not going to look good. We'll figure out where to put the camera based on where the actors and the director want to go, particularly in the show. And I think for that, so sort of just philosophically from a lighting perspective, I think it's just about lighting the space and thinking about sort of like a heightened naturalism, particularly for this show. What can we do? What feels real coming in through the windows in like sunny California, 1950s California? What feels right? And is going to also offer us flexibility to be able to switch from, you know, a bright sunny day to night, or slightly cloudy day, or magic hour-y type thing. So we built a pretty decently significant rig into our studio spaces. And yeah, we work from there. I think I just try and keep as much stuff like film stuff offset as possible, particularly in a period piece, just, you know, in service of the performances.
What do you mean? Like, I think, flags and cutters and.
Yeah. I think a lot of times it's like the right light in the right place might not necessarily need to have a lot of flags and stuff on it. And if we are going to bring something in, I like to do it fast so that we're not, you know, taking the actors out of their performance between takes and things like that. I think it's really about sort of like embracing some imperfection to further performance and give the actors time with the director. That being said, I think planning from the beginning to have, you know, if you talk about sort of the front side of the actor's face to camera being a little darker, I am usually trying to build and block scenes with light coming from the back or three quarters or from the side, not necessarily from the front generally. Mm-hmm. Just as a personal taste thing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if it was, I was wondering if it was saying something about her character that she's not fully open to the possibilities or like, well, like I was, because I felt like she, not alone, but you know, like obviously, you know, Brie Larson looks great on camera. So you're not like trying to hide anything about Brie Larson, but it just felt like she just kept landing kind of in, like it felt organic to her character, I guess is what I'm really saying.
Well, we had an interesting thing with the beginning where we knew that we would be doing the sort of like oneer that drops us right in and we're going through a character's world. We don't know who at the time, we don't see her face.
It's very good, Goodfellas. Loved it.
Thank you. Where we just have her in just straight TV studio lighting. So we have this sort of glimpse of her face in the very beginning that's very brightly lit and kind of like we spent a lot of time really trying to get that last final push in on her face perfect.
Yeah.
Because for first time we're going to see this character. And I did feel like in there with her, from a lighting and camera perspective, because we have her in our head already. We have,
well, yeah, we saw her on a TV set. That's like very high key, you know, and then, yeah, like, I guess life doesn't tend to be as high key as, you know, when you're on a cooking show.
Yeah. Well, and it feels like in a way it's a little bit like, you know, if you're in a conversation with someone and you're whispering so that they lean in.
Yeah.
The sort of like idea of that with keeping her not so, we don't get the clear image of her for a long time again.
Yeah.
And it's, I think just really all in service of hopefully bringing the viewer in and getting them to lean in and want to be engaged with these characters.
What kind of lenses, filters, that kind of vibe, which feels period specific, or it feels like we're watching a little bit of a period film, but it wasn't like an overwhelming amount of it. Like how do you go about like kind of choosing the lenses, choosing if you were using filters, like how did you go about creating that look?
Well, so we used the Alexa Mini LF and Canon K35s, which are very popular lenses that Canon made in the 60s and 70s. And they are just very flattering. We tested a lot of different lenses. And I just felt like with the colors that Kat Smith, the production designer, was coming with, and the sort of like pastels and not necessarily like primary colors, but a lot more secondaries, the contrast and the soft contrast and the color rendition of those lenses kind of worked perfectly for us. Another thing we did was develop a LUT that was really sort of like a film emulation, like so many of us are doing all the time, where Ian Vertovec, a colorist at Light Iron, and I.
Oh, were, I know Ian. I know Ian really well. Yeah,
yeah. I'm sure he's been on a few times. He's a great.
We've
guy.
Never actually had him on, but I worked with him a long time ago when he was still working with when Michael Cioni was still at Light Iron.
Okay. Yeah. So much information, stored up in one person. But yeah. He and I were looking at, because the food, the show was so food focused. Initially it was much more food focused, and over time and over episodes, and because of actor relationships and the sort of like wonderful chemistry between Lewis and Brie that the show changed a little bit. But initially there was a lot more food, and I had sort of initially approached like making a LUT as like, let's look at this old food photography, which I thought was really cool. And you know, we were looking at old ads from the 50s and 60s and looking at old cookbooks and like some episodes of Julia Child and things like that, and just seeing what things looked like. And we found, I think, a really like cool happy medium between that and like a Stephen Shore photograph, which I know is from a later period, but again, like we weren't looking to be super accurate necessarily to the 50s, just know that we were looking backwards.
But like, what were you able to take from those, from that photography? Was it a more of a lighting thing? Was it which kinds of lenses to use? Like, what was the,
I think a little bit of like, let's see what the contrast is in these images. Let's see what black looks like. Let's see how it renders certain colors and, you know, what different kinds of lighting look like. I think we picked a sort of like, as our white point, a slightly warmer white point, just to, I guess, you know, from an outsider's point of view, to feel the California of it all. And I think it just came together nicely. I really like, you know, some of my favorite photography in the series is early on outside this lab that they work at. That's just natural light photography. But I feel like we got look-wise very close to like some of my favorite Stephen Shore photographs, just in a color rendition and contrast aspect. And I think, you know, the Alexa does natural light really well and can feel very naturalistic in a really pretty way.
That's cool. I mean, let's talk a little bit more about the food stuff, because food figures into the show, you know, fairly prominently. If you're doing John Wick, you're going to spend a lot of time on the fights. And if you're doing something like this, that's about someone who's kind of obsessed with kind of food science. I don't know what they would have called it back then, but the science of creating food today, don't they call it like gastronomic, something like, how much emphasis, like when you guys were working on that stuff, you know, was it sort of like, stop the world, we got to get this food stuff right, and spending a whole lot of like, did it become kind of like almost like fetishistically focused on that stuff?
It did. And in prep, we were really trying to come up with a way to link, you know, the character's brilliance with chemistry to her ability with cooking. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of stuff in the initial scripts that was about like, here's the Maillard reaction. Here's what happens when water hits this temperature and a fat hits this. And we're like, it's funny. Like we're just thinking about so much like the molecular stuff. And I've said this a couple times before, but like we initially were really trying to get down to the molecular level. And this, we were shooting near when, or we finished near when Oppenheimer came out. And when I saw Oppenheimer, how good it looked, I was just like, oh my goodness, thank goodness we didn't try and do this, because it's just so far superior to what we had been planning. But we went down a lot of different avenues with like what the food was going to be, aside from just like, okay, here's a pretty shot of a food of, you know, a lasagna that she's making, or here's a pretty shot of like this chicken. There was a lot of like, what happens to two pieces of pasta together in boiling water? And so, okay, how are we going to shoot that? Like, how are we going to see it change? How are we going to shoot inside an oven to see, you know, fat crisp on the skin of a chicken? And we had engaged with some like tabletop macro photography specialists, and we're really kind of trying to work out how much that would be in there. And of course, like most things, you know, it kind of didn't make it. Most things like this, it didn't quite make it into the shooting schedule before we started principal photography. Mm-hmm. And as we were shooting and scripts were still being written and kind of developing, we realized that it was kind of an unnecessary crutch, and that Brie was just, the acting was so strong that we did not need to like aid it visually, I guess, is the right way to put it. So we ended up not doing any of that stuff. And we had put, you know, a decent amount of research into figuring out how it would fit in. How do you cut something like that into a scene? How do you, we tried a lot of different things. And ultimately it ended up being just the most kind of like naturalistic, simply shot, but slightly complicated blocked stuff that worked the best. It felt like the show and felt like the right thing for the show.
Well, it's so character focused. And, you know, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but like when you're doing something that really is, you know, character driven, like this is, and again, you already kind of said you try not to have too much gack on the floor that people are going to walk into or whatever, or say, let's not go over here. But like, what do you feel like are the constraints like walking into a scene? How much prep, like before you walked into a scene, did you have an idea of the blocking? Did you and the director go over what the coverage was going to be, or did they block the actors first and you had to figure out, or you and the director had to figure out how you were going to cover it at that point? Or like, what was that dance for you?
I think a little bit of both. I think certain things we knew how they would block out. So there are a few walk and talks, for instance, in the first episode that we wanted to do not on Steadicam because we just wanted to be more controlled than that. So we had a stabilized three axis head just on a dolly. So for instance, like we worked with the production designer and the grips to make sure that we could do that and make the hallway the right size and length so that we could drive a dolly down it and the dolly could take turns with people walking, things like that. And as you said before, the sets were very generous. So we had that flexibility just from a technical and like gear standpoint. We had the flexibility of being able to fit lots of different things that we wanted to use in most of the sets. So we wanted to like give the actors not complete freedom, but thematically what felt like as much freedom as we could give them, if that makes sense. I think just kind of like not having things be small and tweaky.
Now, you know, you shot half of the series. There's 8 episodes. You shot 4 of them, and you shared the cinematography duties with Jason Oldak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about the collaboration between you two. Like, did you set the look? Did he come on later? Was he involved in pre-production while you were getting ready to do the first one? And like, I'm always interested in the communication when more than one person shoots a series, because these days we kind of have every version of that. We have, you know, a bunch of different DPs shooting the same series, or we have like in this, you have two very specific people, or you have sometimes just one person shooting the whole series. You know, like what was behind the choice to have more than one cinematographer on there? And like, how did the two of you guys communicate to make sure that you're making the same show?
Well, I think that on a show like this, it's really beneficial to have two DPs, just because with multiple directors, it's really hard to prep your episodes in a way and plan for sort of special types of shots and coverage. If you don't have time with the director beforehand to just sit because you're on set, I've done it both ways and done full seasons of shows before. And I think there's sort of pros and cons to both of them. But on this one, Jason came in, you know, after we started shooting the first block, and he's a great DP. It's a fun challenge to come in and use someone else's toolbox, I guess I'd say. The way that I like to work on set is that everybody is collaborating. I really love, you know, giving the gaffer, giving the A camera operator, giving the focus pullers room to collaborate and be a part creatively of everything. Mm-hmm. I think they're, you know, empowered to do that. And so multiple DPs working, you know, of course, each DP, we're hired for our taste. And so everybody has things that they like and don't like. But I think it's, you know, unless you really go out of your way to try and do something drastically different, like once the tools the camera and the lenses and the sets are mostly lit. Like, I think anybody who's good is going to be able to sort of like follow that same, in the same sort of like direction laid out from the beginning.
But I mean, was there a discussion of like, these tend to be the focal lengths we're using. We tend to use this kind of lighting.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think it's, you know, none of it is hard and fast rules because every script is different and every director and what every director asks for is going to be different. But I think, yeah, the show used wider lenses mostly. There were certain lenses that worked better for different character spaces. We really didn't do any handheld. We tried to shoot each scene in as few shots as possible to get the information and performance across. Like those kind of things, the sort of general guidelines, I think, give everyone enough of a sort of pattern to fit in. And I think Jason did a great job.
Cool. And, you know, also like dealing with multiple directors, and I know it's not the cinematographer's job to ever tell a director what to do. And it's probably more something that is gone over with the showrunner and the director. But on this or any other show, have you ever had a situation where a director was like, well, I want to do it like whatever it is. Like, I want to do this one handheld. And you're like, handheld isn't really part of the visual signature of the show, or would how diplomatically, how would you handle a situation like that? Because ultimately I feel like, you know, you're the author of the image of the show, you know, and so, you know, you kind of set the look and do you ever have to sort of safeguard that it has the integrity that you put into it from the beginning?
I think occasionally you'll run into things like that. It's never so nefarious. It's more, you know, I think sometimes ignorance than negligence, mm-hmm. I guess I'd say. And it's like usually a show don't tell approach works with a situation like that, where we can talk about everything else we've done and why this might stick out. And I think directors are, being a TV director is hard when you come in and the whole crew has been working together and you kind of come in and are expected to take over and put your own imprint on it while existing within this framework that's been set up by other creative people to work for them. So I just like to talk to directors about things as much beforehand and say, we usually don't do that. Why do you think that's a good idea? Or something like that. And I mean, if they want to do it, ultimately we all work for them and they work for the showrunner. So I don't think I would necessarily ever say no to a director, but might lodge this is different than what we've been doing, but I see why you did this and let's try it out.
So, like aside from the fact that you're nominated for an Emmy, which is freaking awesome. But like, you know, like what are some of the things about the show that you yourself are most proud of that, you know, like, again, me as a viewer might just be watching it even to interview you and thinking like, what's noteworthy, but like, what are the things that would go right past me, but like, were really hard fought on your side?
What I feel like is really successful about the show is just the sort of like comprehensive world building that we did, just from a rules of aesthetics standpoint. Mm-hmm. I feel like it all really feels like a piece, despite being shot at lots of different times and places. And like, I feel like it's really, you know, we capture an era without being nostalgic about it, which is like really what we wanted to do. I feel like the show was successful that I really like how we lit the sets. I think we got a really like nice naturalistic look in a lot of them that is it's hard, but when you do it well, it looks easy, and it's a testament to the gaffer Len Levine and the key grip Adam Kaligas that I think some of the stuff that we pulled off. I think just really looking back now, we shot like 2.5 years ago at this point with the strikes and everything. And like, yeah. It was, I have rose-colored glasses thinking about the crew. I you know, looking back on it, and just it was a really good time, and really enjoyed all the people that collaborated to make it come together.
Yeah, it's a really cool show, and it's the kind of show that I'm like, as TV gets back in its footing, you know, post strikes, but post everything, it's, you know, all the consolidation. Like, I'm terrified that shows like this won't continue being made, you know, because, you know, like they're just cut back so much on what's getting made, and so much of what's getting made is just being made for the biggest, broadest audience. And I love a good character piece that's just, you know, solid. And, you know, Apple's maybe in a different position because Apple can sort of do whatever it wants, but
it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of years. I keep vacillating back and forth between all kinds of different theories about what might come next. I'm hoping mid-budget movies come back. That's my
You and me both, man.
That's what I'm after, and what I feel like I hear a lot of people talking about. I think we're, you know, the streamers have decided how much money that they're going to spend and make, and they kind of have saturation, right? Like,
yeah,
how many more people can join streamers? So I feel like the way for them to make money is to make a bunch of like $20 million movies.
From your mouth to God's ears. I actually just went and saw Long Legs recently, and I think that was a $10 million movie. Looks amazing. First time DP, or first time feature DP, I should say.
Everybody's talking about it. Yeah,
it's so different. It's so different than everything else that's out there. And, you know, I mean, like, you know, I'm sure I'll go see Deadpool and Wolverine and all that stuff. But, you know, it to me, you know, those are the more exciting films because they surprise you. And, you know, when you're in, like, and actually Long Legs on a freaking Thursday night, there was a pretty big audience, and you could hear them reacting. And I'm like, this is why I like going. It's not, I mean, the size of the screen is great, the sound is great, but it's like the communal experience of watching this with a group of people. You know,
there's been so much good TV that I like, you can forget about that experience. You can go a long time watching stuff and not. I feel like we used to go to the theater so much more.
Yeah,
and it's so important that it stays alive and that we keep going and supporting, particularly independent film, but all movies.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I hope you're right. I mean, I feel like that might be something that starts to happen more because you have a lot of talent out there. You have a lot of, you know, great cinematographers, directors, actors, et cetera, et cetera. And if they don't have an outlet on TV, they're going to find an outlet for them. You know, like, they're going to be looking for it. And, you know, I think it's worth the risk when you see when they really do work. You know?
Actors want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they want to do the work. So, I kind of want to know just a little bit more about you. And I feel like we've been, so focused on doing like one project interviews, you know, where we're just talking to someone, drilling down about one project, that I feel like we've lost what we used to do a lot, which was, you know, kind of just do kind of the career survey, you know, and we would get people in. And so I haven't asked this question in a long time, but like, what was the moment in your life when you realized that being a cinematographer was a career path you could pursue, that it was a job and it was something you could do? What brought you here?
Well, I didn't initially know that I wanted to be a cinematographer. I thought I was probably wanted to be a director when I was a kid, but my dad took me to see Pulp Fiction when I was 13 years old, and that did it. And I was just like, okay, I'm definitely going to do film. My dad was in the business, sort of, like, he was like a commercial and documentary and like industrials director. Mm-hmm. So he was doing smaller stuff, different, not narrative stuff, but like, I was kind of on set since I was a kid, and just saw, you know, set etiquette and how things worked. And he got me into movies at a very young age. And then I, you know, did high school and was like, I'm going to go to film school. But when I got into film school, realized that it was much more about prerequisites than actually making stuff. So I dropped out and started driving a grip truck. And mm-hmm. So I basically
Dare I ask what film school you were trying to get?
I went to Hofstra University for a year and a half because I didn't have good enough grades to get in NYU, but I wanted to be near the city.
Were you in the film school?
At Hofstra, yeah.
But I mean, like, one of my film teachers, I think, still is a teacher there. His name is Jerry Hooper. I don't know if he was there when you were there.
I don't know. The name sounds familiar, but it was chills so long ago now.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't a good fit for me. And I knew that I just wanted to be making stuff. And so, yeah, I ended up working in like a warehouse, just packing trucks full of lights for like a year and a half, and then started going out on sets and kind of worked my way up into the lighting crew from there. I was a gaffer for a bit, a non-union gaffer, and kind of like right at the point where it would have been like, time to join the union, I started shooting actually like student films. And bought a Canon 5D and shot like a million student films, short films, and like music videos with friends and just little projects and short films and stuff like that. And one of the first directors I worked with, that we did, you know, a million music videos for no money for, got a feature. And that first feature got into Sundance competition. And it was kind of like, just, you know, like we just got super lucky. And, I mean, that we worked hard and also got super lucky, but it was, you know, just kind of did the indie film thing for a while. And then was sort of
What was the film that got into Sundance?
It was called Sleepwalker. Mm-hmm. It was in maybe 2014 competition. The director's name was Mona Fastwold, and it had Chris Abbott, Brady Corbett, and a couple actors from overseas. And we, it was all like friends making a movie together. And it was like, I was just totally hooked. So glad that I went, you know, into the narrative route. I'd been working a lot in commercials and music videos and was like, as I'm shooting, I don't want to compete with my friends and I love storytelling. So I'm going to try and do this. I was gaffing for a while, but I never was on a movie set really until I was shooting it. I'd just done commercials and music videos and stuff. So it was like, I had the tools, but I didn't know exactly how to apply them. So it was really like learning over the process of a few movies.
What are the habits and proclivities of a music video and commercial DP that didn't automatically occur to you or worked against you when you got on a narrative set?
Well, like learning how to match lots of different angles within a scene, or like learning about what eye lines were, for instance. So it's like a big learning about the line and how, you know, different shots affect different, will elicit different feelings in a viewer, or just what different ways to move the camera. I think, you know, music videos are so fun because you're not, there's no sort of like contract with the viewer about what you're doing. It's in service to the song, and it's going to be short, and it should be as visually as cool as possible. But
yeah,
I think you know, in narrative stuff, learning that just the coolest looking thing is not always the right thing was something to learn as well. And just sort of, you know, I think like if I stepped back in time now and looked at that, like how much I tried to move the actors to the camera as opposed to move the camera to the actors, I think would be a big, you know, thing that it takes time to learn, and things that I didn't learn before I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I continued to shoot indie films for a while and got really lucky. Got to have some other films go to other festivals and, you know, make some connections with directors. And then I got my first TV show was a show called Manhunt Unabomber, with a showrunner director named Greg Utanis.
I know the guy, Johnny Burchold, who played the Unabomber as a kid.
Oh, nice.
Like when he was in college, he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. We shot like, these MK Ultra scenes with him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a cool guy.
But yeah. And then TV, you know, indie, I feel like indie film trained me really well for TV because it was kind of the same sort of like pace, just scaled up and with a lot more support. Where it's like, well, your lighting setup better be right on the first time because there's no time to like change it too much. And yeah, just TV I've been able to sprinkle in a few movies between TV shows, but since that first one, it's been just TV projects are so long that, hoping to get into more movies soon.
I mean, are you omnivorous in that way? Like, you know, you like doing a little bit of one and a little bit of the other, or is there one that you prefer?
No, I really like going back and forth, and I feel lucky, extremely lucky in that I'm just getting access to projects that, access to scripts and projects that I really like and that I have kind of been, I guess, you know, I've been at it doing the same thing for a while now. So I've got a really great circle of collaborators and people that I really enjoy working with.
I think that's an awesome place to leave it. Before we go, do you have like a website or a Instagram? I know you have both of those, so spoiler alert, I've been on both, but where you'd like to direct people to check out your work?
Sure, my website is just my name, ZacharyGaller.com, and I think my Instagram is the same thing, or like Zachary, my Instagram is Zachary_Galler. I can't thank you enough for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We're very excited about your show. We're in your corner. All right, so that was Zachary Galler. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Everybody, check out Lessons in Chemistry, which is currently streaming on Apple TV.
That's the one, Apple TV Plus. Yeah.
Okay.
You forgot what it was called for a second.
I'm just going to leave my idiocy in there. It's the one with the Apple logo on it.
It looks like a bite was taken out of it.
Yummy. Anyway.
Hey, Ben, you'll never guess what time it is now.
It is 10:07 p.m. as my clock tells me.
It's wrong. It is bill paying time. We have to thank our fine friends over at Aputure, makers of all kinds of cool lighting products. Lights for cinema, lights for television, lights for influencers, you name it. Aputure makes a lot of lights. But what a lot of people don't know or don't remember when they think of Aputure is that they also make some really cool lighting networking control products. And I'm speaking specifically of like DMX Control and of course their famous Citus Link, which is a wireless system for controlling lights. They have a new product called the Citus 4. The Citus 4 gives you 4 wireless CRMX and 4 hardwired DMX universes, so 8 universes total, and it gives you a whole lot of options. We're going to have a link to the product in the show notes, so you can definitely check it out. But just to run off a few, of course, I already said CRMX, DMX, but there's also ArtNet, and of course, Citus Bluetooth. All of those are built into it. The thing is IP65 rated, meaning it can get wet, meaning it can get dusty. It's still going to continue to work. It also has a V-mount plate, so you can plop a battery on it and power it for more than a day, which is really cool. Yeah. Which is really great. You can get some really big, huge VMAP batteries now, and you can plop it on this thing. So anyway, check out the Citus 4. Of course, it's available over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. We'll have a link there. You want to check it out. But for those of you who are lighting professionals, for those of you who are gaffers, or are you involved in lots and lots of... I almost forgot one of the coolest things about it. It's daisy chainable. So you can link together more and more universes. So you can go from 8 to 16 to 32. You can link these together and have more and more control over your lights. So super cool. Citus 4 and under $2,500 list price. And I know it's a pretty powerful system at a pretty aggressive price. So definitely worth taking a look at. If you need to have DMX control, you could do a lot worse than Citus 4.
Hey, can I tell you a random Aputure story?
Random away.
I fell into a YouTube hole of Aputure's YouTube channel, mm-hmm. and they have an extremely informative YouTube channel. And I think what got me on there was that I've done a lot of projection design stuff, and it was their host talking to a DP about using video projectors as lighting instruments, and like how to do projection mapping and kind of the basics of that. And I was looking at it and I'm like, there's some free application that he was recommending for projection mapping. I think I would still probably go with something like QLab, which I'm used to using, which costs money, but is actually a relatively inexpensive app. I found myself watching a bunch of their videos, and they've got a pretty awesome YouTube channel. It's worth checking out.
All right. Awesome. Yeah, it's totally worth checking out. Aperture has done a lot of cool stuff over the years.
And now, Short Ends.
Okay, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions. Is there something this week you are obsessed about?
Obsessed? I went and saw a movie that I'd seen a couple trailers for that looked fascinating, and I have to say that the trailer in no way prepared me for the movie. It's super whacked, like crazy, wacky, zany. It's a movie called Cuckoo. It is a horror movie.
It is surprise.
It is not for everyone. It's directed by somebody named Tillman Singer, and it is shot by somebody named Paul Faltz. It looks amazing. Might have one of my favorite single shots I've seen in a movie in years. It's got a great shot. Although a friend of mine pointed out to me that it is not dissimilar from a shot in the John Carpenter movie In the Mouth of Madness. But Cuckoo is sort of about a family that goes to live in this place, and there's a young teenage daughter who gets a job at a nearby hotel, and it's almost impossible to explain why, but in the first 15 minutes, nothing bad had happened in the movie, and there was something about the way it was shot, something about the way it was staged, something about the way it was edited, something about the sound design that made me super uncomfortable before anything bad had even ever happened.
Wow.
And it gets crazy. I will compare it favorably to early David Cronenberg, like Scanners era David Cronenberg. It's not like Scanners, but it's like there's a vibe that's kind of like that, and it's absolutely scary, and it's in theaters right now. Probably won't be there for long, and I'm sure you'll be able to catch it on, I don't know, Shudder, Amazon Prime or something before we know it, but I think it's worth seeing in the theater. That's where I saw it, and I just want to give my full-throated endorsement of that movie, and anything I'm excited to see anything that Tillman Singer does in the future. I watched his first film, which is called Luz, L-U-Z.
And, as in for light?
Yeah, but it's a character's name.
Okay, that could be. Woman's name,
it's an excellent film, and go check it out in the theater if you have the wherewithal to do so right now. Run, excellent. Don't walk. But only if you
if you're a horror fan, really
super messed up, very bizarre movies.
Cronenberg is your man. Your hero.
I think if you're a David Lynch fan, you'd probably like it too. Like it's definitely a horror film, but I think that if you just like super intense surreal movies, you'll dig it. Anyway.
Yeah, it sounds super intense and right up your alley. I saw someone actually just last week wearing a shirt that said Cronenberg for president, which I thought was pretty great.
That wouldn't work though. He's Canadian.
Well, I mean, still dream. dare to dream. So.
Yeah, I'd go for John Carpenter for president. Like. Mm-hmm. Okay. Pretty American, the guy there. Anyway,
I appreciate you like throwing a little cold water on that T-shirt there. That was.
Yeah, I'm throwing cold water all over that T-shirt, even though yes, I would be perfectly happy to have David Cronenberg be my leader in
the free world. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Ilya, what is your pet obsession of this week?
Well, I don't know if you've seen it, but there is a new Apple TV Plus series called Sunny. Sunny is about a robot with a particularly sunny disposition. And really, it's a show about Rashida Jones' character. Rashida Jones, Susie, is an American who is living in Japan, and her husband and child die in a plane accident like in a few minutes into episode one. So really giving nothing away here. And then essentially, she kind of ends up going through this dark story of trying to figure out the truth of what her husband was working on, because she thought he worked on refrigerators. Turns out he worked on robots. And the robots are sort of like this, kind of like Wall-E, Apple sort of white, plasticky looking modern sort of thing. But there is sort of a dark, sinister you know, subculture of like robot hackers that's lurking just below the surface. And if you like shows that are a little bit off and a little bit weird, and really this show has a lot to do with grief and it's billed as a comedy. And so I always think it's really interesting when it's a show about grief, but there's laughs along the way. So there's laugh, there is some definite comedy, but it is also about this woman who's going through a really, really terrible time. And there's sort of like the Yakuza makes an appearance and there's like all this intrigue. Like, so yeah, Sunny on Apple TV Plus, highly recommend it. I'm only in like 3 episodes now, but I think they're up to like 5 or 6, so I gotta get caught up. But really auspicious start, and I'm gonna keep watching. It's been great.
Check it out. That sounds cool. Yeah.
All right, so Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to find you somewhere outside of the show?
Just go to the Starbucks on the corner of Burbank and Van Nuys Boulevard.
I know you're there a lot, so that's your haunt. Yeah.
Go to bedrock.com, benrock.com. It sounded like I said bedrock.com. I'm not congested. Yeah. I don't know why I said it like that.
Yeah, bedrock would have been a cool URL. Yeah, it would have been good.
It would have for somebody else. anyway, benrock.com. You can find all my you can find my reel, my bio as it is, social media stuff, all that. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. That's where I'm at most days, Monday through Friday, either in Los Angeles or in Portland. And if not there, you can find me on the LinkedIn or the Instagram. I tend to check both those things once or twice a week. So you can definitely find me in those places. So Ben, who do we have to thank for this show? Who made this show possible?
As always, our amazing producer, Alana Cody, who without whom we would be adrift in space like Dave Poole in 2001 A Space Odyssey after they cut his air and after Hal takes him out and he's just floating around. That would be us.
My mind immediately went to Gravity. But, you know, 2001, perfectly appropriate too.
Perfectly yeah. Cromulent, yeah.
Yeah.
So we should thank her for hooking up all these kick-ass interviews. We have one that I'm very excited about coming up. I have to actually watch the film, but...
that will be helpful, yeah.
It's somebody... I'll lay this much of a hint. It's somebody that we've had on the show before who I could not have possibly been more enthusiastic about having on the show at the time.
It should be good. And you are doing it without me, so good for you, man. That's great. It's all
free balling it.
That's right.
So we should also thank our fine editor, Michael Dispenza. Michael, kicking ass. Hopefully we're not making your life too hard. Our wraps are pretty tight tonight.
Pretty good.
And last but never least, we got to thank Kay Zalatrakshi for composing every scrap of music that you hear on this podcast. You can get him to make an original score for you if you were so inclined. Go to musicbykays.com, listen to some of his stuff, hire him to compose a score or do your visual effects or color grade or direct your next project. He does all of those things very well. He's making a music video right now. Actually, he reached out to me about possibly being in his music video, and I don't know if I should say any more than that. And I was like, you know, I'm not an actor, right? I'm terrible, but I'll probably do it.
I think you should.
Yeah. Anyway, so Ilya, would you like to take us out?
That's a wrap.
Woof. Woof.
All right, how was good. That? Okay, good.
That was good. I'm good with it. I'll accept it. I'm cutting too. Bye.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.